So one of the things that I wanted to start off on, has anybody heard of the word or the concept of reward efficiency? Sorry, Hamlet, you were saying?
I've heard of this.
Can you guys hear me clearly? You're breaking up on your side.
I can hear you fine, Guy. Hamlet, it seems a little broken up.
All right. Well, maybe
I'm getting quite a bit of static, but I can hear. So it's manageable.
Okay.
Can you guys hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's better.
Okay.
All right, so basically the idea with reward efficiency is that some people reckon that a lot of addicts are this thing called reward efficient, which basically simply is if you're producing too little or too much of certain neurotransmitters in the brain. And if that is the case, then there's certain symptoms associated with it. And what a lot of people suspect is that reward efficiency, there's a causal relationship between the two, that people that are reward efficient are more prone to the abuse of substances, because obviously substances rectify certain reward efficiencies. So if you're naturally inclined to have low dopamine levels when you take drugs or behaviors that increase dopamine, it sort of rectifies that reward efficiency momentarily. And that's obviously something that one is going to experience as pretty nice, because the deficiency feels like a lack in oneself. So it's like being thirsty. And when you drink water, there's a sort of relief associated with that. And I think there's some merit in that theory, because trauma, there's a lot of things that also cause reward efficiency, and one of them is trauma. So if you had some trauma as a kid in some form of dysfunctional family, that's going to have effect on your neurophysiology and have effect on reward efficiency. So why I'm bringing this up as well is that what they believe is that if people, even if you've been in recovery a while and you're doing all the psycho-spiritual stuff and the social stuff, it's not necessarily going to rectify your brain's reward efficiency. So a lot of people still suffer from what they call abstinence symptoms, which is basically reward efficiency symptoms that carry on quite long into a recovery process. So what I wanted to look at is ways that one can assist in rectifying reward efficiency, and certain practices that can pretty much help with that. Is everyone still with me on that?
Yes. Guy, is it reward deficiency with a D or reward efficiency with an E?
Reward deficiency with a D, like in a deficit. Yeah. So what I wanted to look at specifically tonight is, like, last week we spoke quite a lot around diet, and one of the things that we briefly touched upon was a healthy digestive system. Now, one of the things that drugs affect probably the most profoundly physiologically is one's digestive system. And if there's problems with a digestive system, then that's also going to lead to reward efficiency. For one of the simple reasons is that a lot of the neurotransmitters actually get made in the stomach. A very large percentage of all serotonin gets made in the stomach. So if one's digestive system isn't working properly, especially your gut lining, then that's definitely going to have effect on reward efficiency and sort of plague one with the symptoms of that. So one of the first things I recommend to people when I work with them in recovery from a physiological perspective is I get them to take supplements and nutrition that can help heal the gut lining. Because obviously drugs, and especially certain drugs like heroin, and alcohol in particular, or painkillers, really eat away the gut lining. And if you don't do any sort of significant treatment to that, it's not just going to come right by itself. It can stay like that for quite a while. So one of the first things one can do to start rectifying reward deficiency is just to make sure that the gut is working properly by taking stuff like glutamine and obviously prebiotics, etc. And then the second thing that I'm quite a big fan of, especially when it comes to reward efficiency, is the acids. Now, I know everyone knows about omega-3, and obviously that's a good thing. But as far as essential fats go, there's also another type of fat that a lot of people don't take, and you really need to take that with omega-3 for it to work adequately in the brain for restoring brain tissue, and that's phospholipids. And there's two supplements that I always recommend to people. The one is called phosphatidylcholine, and the other one is called phosphatidylserine. And if one takes very high doses of omega-3 with adequate doses of phosphatidylcholine and phosphatidylserine, you know, the change is quite remarkable. In the treatment center I worked at one stage, we had that as a basic supplement. And as soon as people started taking that, you could literally see a change within 2 weeks as far as concentration goes and just general mood goes. And I think the reason that it works so well is because it's got the phospholipids as well, because omega-3 on its own is only one half of the fatty acid sort of equation. Your nerve cells, the sheaths of it are actually made out of phospholipids. So it's really essential that one takes that with the omega-3 as well.
Guy, I have a question.
Yeah?
That supplement or that nutrient that you were just speaking about, does that come together, or are you recommending that someone take omega-3s along with this other nutrient? Is my first question.
Yeah. Well, they never get packaged together. I've never actually seen a supplement that's got both of them in it. Maybe like a supplement with a lot of things, but then it's normally very low doses. So I would suggest you get it. Sorry?
What omega-3 sources are you recommending? Because they're found in, you know, you can take walnuts or flax seeds. You can also drink fish oil. Which omega-3 source are you recommending?
I mean, fish oil. But obviously the expensive ones, the ones that are purified, not the cheap ones, because they will have mercury and stuff. The problem is with flaxseed, which a lot of people aren't aware of, is that quite a large percentage of people have, it's not that they're allergic to flaxseed, but a lot of people have got a certain gene that doesn't let them break down flaxseed. And if you do have that, when you take flaxseed, it's actually going to cause inflammation because your body can't digest it, and it becomes a sort of pathogen in a way. So, you know, it's pretty tricky to find out if you have that condition or not. So just to be safe, then I just recommend the fish oil.
And what is the other nutrient? I know you mentioned it, but I want to write it. I want to spell it out. Do you mind spelling it out for me?
Yeah, it's a P-H.
Uh-huh.
O-S.
Uh-huh.
P-H.
Uh-huh.
A-T-I. D Y L. Phosphatidyl.
Okay.
And you get two types, choline and serine.
Choline? What?
Choline and serine.
S E R I N E?
Yeah.
Okay. And it's phosphatidyl. P H O S P H. A T is in Tom, I E Y L.
That's right.
Okay.
The most important one is the choline. It's also the cheapest. The serine is quite expensive. And if you have beans in Technicolor, you take the serine. it's remarkable. You start taking that in your dream. That
how do you spell serine?
Sorry.
I'm sorry, guy. How do you spell the serine? S E
I R S E R I N E
R I N. Okay.
Yeah. I've actually seen people write poetry about phosphatidylserine because of this dream enhancing properties. Stress absence. Those things, we take those three supplements, and I'm obviously just focusing now on brain function, not the whole body. Those three supplements together will make a significant difference to your brain function. And if you have reward deficiency, it's going to not necessarily rectify it, but it will make a significant improvement in the right direction. And I've seen that over and over. I'm not sure what brands you guys have in the States. I normally try and stick with Solgar.
We have Solgar.
I think it's an American company. So I try and stick with Solgar. You can seldom go wrong with them.
And Guy, what about a mouse?
Yeah, I normally recommend at least 2,000 milligrams of omega 3. And I'm not so sure about the milligram quantities of the phosphatidyl stuff, but that sort of that can just be the recommended dosage, whatever the bottle says. It's normally like one or two tablets of it a day.
Okay, thank you.
But it's
Solgar, and it has one of the best prices, too. It's like $25 a bottle. I pay more than that for my omega, so that's cool.
Yeah, the choline is quite cheap. The serine is the pricey one.
No, this is serine. It's $24.95. Solgar's 200 milligram soft gels are $25 for...
Okay, that's
cheap. That's not so bad. For 50.
No, that's pretty reasonable. Okay. So the other thing I wanted to briefly touch upon as well, when it comes to physiology, and also one of the areas that there hasn't really been that much work on, or there has been a fair amount to work on, but it hasn't really infiltrated addiction treatment, is you know, as obviously most people are aware on the call, is that, you know, guys like Ken Wilber and a lot of other people would say is that we have more than one body. You know, we have the gross body, and then you also have the subtle energy bodies. And, you know, obviously Western science would also agree with that to some extent because of the electromagnetic fields that surround the gross body, which is a scientific fact. But one of the things that is very seldom explored is how our substance abuse affects the subtle energy bodies, especially over long periods of time, and what one can actually do about affecting that. One of my personal sort of theories is that one of the most damaging aspects of drug abuse isn't so much what it does to the gross body. Even drugs like heroin and those things, you know, you can take heroin quite a long time if you're using good quality heroin and you're not doing it in a dirty environment. And, you know, after a couple of months of stopping it, your body can be fairly back to normal. But obviously one's psyche and those things don't come back to normal. And also the part that doesn't go back to normal very quickly is the energy bodies. And I think Hamlet, you and myself have spoke about the effects of smoking cannabis. And that's one of the things as well, where there's a massive effect on the energy body. But on the gross body, there's, you know, hardly any effect. So one of the things that I think people struggle with a lot is the damage substances has done to their energy bodies, especially the energy bodies that relate to the more emotional realm. And if the energy body is damaged, then, for instance, the energy body that specifically relates to the emotional energy field is the paleo mammalian limbic system, relates to a specific part of our energy bodies. And for one's reward efficiency and also for the rewiring of the brain to happen post recovery, which is, you know, obviously a big part of recovery is to rewire these damaged systems or dysfunctional systems, there needs to be a correlated sort of re-energizing or rewiring of the energy body as well. And one, for instance, the Steiner guys, I'm not necessarily a big Steiner fan, but one of the areas that they focus on a lot is the energy body, and also they've written quite a lot of work on how various drugs affect the energy bodies. and when one explores that a bit more, it sort of seems to make a fair amount of common sense. So what I always suggest to people in early recovery as well, or any stage in recovery, is also to include some energy work in one's process. And that can just be stuff like yoga or Tai Chi. Or Tai Chi is very good because it focuses specifically on the flow of the Chi, on the flow of the energy through the bodies, or forms of meditation that do that. Especially for the people that have abused cannabis, because that's one of the drugs that are, as far as I'm concerned, the most damaging on the energy body system. And also psychedelics also really damages the energy systems a lot compared to other drugs. Like cocaine and heroin and those things, they do serious damage in a lot of areas, but I don't think they're that damaging to the energetic systems than the psychedelic drugs. There's, I don't want to go into that too much, but there seems to be quite a lot of quite a good reason for that. So just in closing, to get to the next point of neurotherapy, so some form of energy balancing or subtle body practices is certainly something that can help one a great deal in early recovery, and that's also going to help the limbic system to start rewiring itself quicker and more functionally. Okay. Anybody wants to add before I go to some neurotherapy stuff?
Yes, I would like to ask a question. It's interesting that you brought up this subject because I was going to ask you this today. So I'm wondering how you feel about this concept that energy or trauma can be stored in cellular memory and contribute to disease or contribute to pain in the body. For example, if you were to look at my lower back, in an MRI, I have an issue going on in L2 and S1, and that causes me to have some pain. Somebody who's looking at it from an energetic perspective will state that I have trauma there, and we can have a conversation about that because this pain did come on at a time when things were going on in my life, etc., right?
Yeah.
So they say that some energy work or mind-body practices such as yoga, as Nikki Myers, who's a yoga instructor who's done some work in 12-step culture, says,
yeah,
you know, getting the issues out of the tissues is how she likes to call it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I have, you know, part of it, to me, it kind of makes sense, but then it also sounds like very new agey sort of,
yeah,
you know, stuff. And I'm wondering what your take is on that.
Well, that's a very good point. My personal feeling is that the area where there's been the biggest load of bullshit written about in general is the area of sort of energy work or energy theory. You know, it's just, as far as I'm concerned, 95% of it is just a load of nonsense. Because it's one of those fields where, you know, it's so unquantifiable, you know, anybody can just come up with their own theory and opinions, and and people just take it too far. And that's a real pity, because I think there's a lot of merit in the idea of energy, energy bodies and energy work. But unfortunately, the field is just filled with quackery that pretty much makes the whole field have a bad reputation. So, you know, I would say that there must be some merit in that the trauma is stored in the body and the trauma is stored in the energy fields. But a lot of people that work in that gives it too much credibility that you can just do some energy work and all your trauma is going to disappear and all your physical symptoms are going to disappear. You know, and I don't think it quite works that way. I mean, I'm by no means an expert in that field. But, yeah, there's just a lot of over-exaggeration, as far as I'm concerned, in that specific area.
But you do believe that traumatic events in one's life can be stored in the body and result in pain, in physical pain?
Well, I think to some extent. I mean, there's a lot of research been done around trauma and cellular memory, you know, and that's not necessarily within in the New Age circles. That's within the field of sort of psychoimmunology and stuff, you know. So there's a very clear direct link between trauma and effects on the body, you know. So that's pretty evident, and how that's going to affect immune system and all those types of things. Well, I get a bit skeptical, or a lot skeptical, is when people would say, you know, you've got some trauma stuck in your bottom left calf, and that's why you're walking skew. You know, I'd be very skeptical of that. But certainly the fact that trauma has got a profound effect in all cells of the body and how the body functions, I mean, that's pretty much a given these days. That's really accepted within, you know, physiological studies. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But I've heard a lot of the stuff, you know, you go to energy work and they say you've got some reptile stuck in your spinal cord and that's why this happens and that happens and it's related to that. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. But if somebody said to me that the reason I've got a stiff back is because I'm stressed and I had some trauma as a kid and that makes my muscles tense and there's some cellular memory left from the trauma, that makes a fair amount of sense to me.
I was very skeptical and a little disappointed at Ken Wilber hosting Donna Eden, who's this big energy practitioner. And I've looked at her work and I know a practitioner of her work, and frankly, I don't buy into the whole thing. I mean, maybe it works. Maybe it's great. I just, for me, where I'm at, I don't buy into it. I think, like what you said, it sounds like a whole lot of New Age bullshit. And, but I tend to really respect anything that comes out of the integral community. And I was, disappointed and almost like I couldn't believe that Ken Wilber, of all people, was actually hosting a, like, 1 or 2 hour dialogue with this woman. And I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with who I'm talking about, Donna Eden. And, no. Okay.
But, I mean, Ken Wilber's always been quite a big fan of that stuff, but if you actually read his own writing about it, it's very clear and very sober. And he doesn't take things too much of an extreme. But he's got some very good writing about the energy systems that just makes a lot of sense. That's not too far fetched. So as far as energy goes, the energy system goes, I think something that is sort of slightly related to that and related to the other two topics is what we've spoken about quite a lot on these lectures is brainwave entrainment. You know, obviously our different brainwave states relate to certain, you know, different emotional states and all those type of things, and our different drugs relate to brainwave states and et cetera. And one of the field that virtually all brainwave entrainment theory is really based on from the research is the work that's been done in neurotherapy, sort of neurobiofeedback. And there's been a massive amount of work, research been done in that, and a substantial amount of evidence for its efficacy. And I've worked quite closely with people that do neurofeedback in the context of addiction. And I've seen remarkable results with that stuff. And if one starts exploring the mechanism behind that and the theory behind that, and also the theory of how addiction affects brain states, then it makes perfect sense. I've always felt that neurotherapy will become a very prominent form of addiction treatment in the future, when it becomes more affordable and more accessible. But why that's also important for me is that understanding our addiction will affect brain states, because there's obviously different ways to look at the brain. You can look at it from a neurochemical perspective. You can look at it from the way it generates thoughts, from a sort of psychological perspective. But then the other perspective is this idea of states. And also Ken Wilber's work also deals with how different brainwave states actually correlate with different sort of energy bodies as well. But I don't want to get in that too much. But clearly one of the things, or one of the areas that the chronic abuse of substances is going to do to one's brain, you know, if we're specifically looking at the brain as a physiological organ and not too focused on the mental aspects of it, is how our brain functions from a state perspective. And one of the things that's really important and interesting as well is that our brain states can also be out of whack, in the same way that our neurophysiology can be out of whack from, you know, many reasons. And we all know that if you don't sleep for 2 nights, you know that your brain isn't working properly, you know, in 48 hours. You know, you're feeling depressed and anxious and agitated and all sorts of things. And the reason for that is that your brain hasn't been able to recuperate, regenerate itself. And the consequences is there's low neurotransmitter levels, or there's a balance. Now, obviously, addiction and drugs have got a very profound effect on the state of our brain, you know, whether it generates alpha or theta or beta or whatever. So when you take drugs over long periods of time, it really changes the way that your brain goes into various states. So somebody that's abused heroin for a long time will find, apart from the physiological irregularities that will be as a consequence of that, you'll also find that his brain state, there'll be irregularities in his brain state in ways that he will find it very difficult to access certain brain states that would be associated with heroin. For instance, he would find it very difficult to access more relaxed sort of soothing states by himself, because that is the state that heroin provided, and as a consequence, that state became diminished in the person's own capacity to provide that. So if one had to, if you do something like a QEEG, which is a sort of reading of the different brain states all over the brain, and a lot of people also don't quite get, the brain isn't in one state. So you're not in an alpha state or a theta state or a beta state. There's many regions on the brain, and each of these regions on the brain can be in different states and in various degrees of that state. So the only real way to know how your brain is functioning from a state perspective is to do a proper QEEG. And then they do a sort of readout on how various parts of your brain correlate to various states under certain conditions. And then you can start figuring out which parts, you know, which part of your frontal lobe or the whichever part has got certain dysfunction in brain states. And, you know, with the most addicts that I've encountered that have done QEEGs, there's always a significant there's always a very clear issue when you actually do a brain scan, and it clearly shows that there's certain parts of their brain that just isn't functioning properly from a state perspective. And then one of the aims of neurotherapy would be is to start training the brain are to access these states by itself. It's sort of like brain gym in a way, are to generate the appropriate state in the appropriate region of the brain. And that's also one of the therapies that I've just seen people change remarkably over such short periods of time. Because, you know, in neurotherapy, it's like tuning your engine of your car. You know, all the things might be there. You know, the petrol might be flowing in your trucks might be working, but all these things can be out of tune, and that just means your car isn't going properly. So when you take it for service and you tune these things to the right levels, then the whole system just runs smoother. So it's just one of those things where people always speak about addiction as being a brain disease and it affects your brain and all that type of thing. But if you look at people's recovery programs or recovery practices, there's actually very seldom that the recovery programs actually include specific practices that also heals the brain organically as a physiological entity. And obviously, the brain is one of the areas that suffer the most from drugs. So, you know, just in closing, I think if you combine stuff like the right nutrition with the right supplements that specifically target healthy brain functioning, with some energy work and also stuff like neurotherapy and brainwave entrainment also works very well. The problem with brainwave entrainment is that it only entrains at one frequency, and it sort of entrains the whole brain to some extent, which, you know, is not very, very specific, although it's still a good process. But if one ever has the opportunity to do that type of nutritional stuff, the supplements, in conjunction with practice like neurotherapy, that is one of the stuff that can truly rectify a lot of the reward deficient problems that certainly the vast majority of addicts experience when they clean up, and also experience into quite late recovery.
I was offered. I have a friend who owns a neurotherapy center here in Miami, Florida, called Brain Training Centers, I think, of Florida or something like that. And I was offered that some time ago while I was using, and I went to several visits, and, you know, they had me plugged into this dark room all wired up to my brain and had me staring at the computer screen doing all these different exercises and trying to lower the little ball and this whole thing. And I wish I would have known that was actually effective, I thought at the time. Yeah. I'm like, this
well,
is...
Well, it's not how much to be smoking crack in the meantime, you know what I mean?
Right. And I would go in there usually after binges, and they would tell me, like, you need to get your brain working again, you know, or otherwise you're just not going to thrive in recovery. And they would get me in there, and a lot of the time I would fall asleep because I was so wiped out.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I wish I would have known back then that it was such a good thing. I would have taken advantage of it at the time, but I didn't think it was anything worthwhile. But I have been through that process.
Yeah. Well, there's been some research with a guy called Peniston quite a while back. He developed a thing called the Peniston Protocol for Alcoholics. And their success rate was treating people just with neurotherapy without any additional therapy was very high. I mean, obviously a couple of small studies, so one doesn't want to take that as the issue too seriously. But it certainly showed a huge promise. There was a lot of people that could just stay clean just from neurotherapy alone without any additional stuff. So I can only imagine if you do that in conjunction with the sort of whole integral practice, the effect it can have.
Yeah.
Sorry, this is Heidi. I'm just muting you sometimes. We're getting some background noise from you, Hamlet. But I've tried to not when you want to talk. But I don't know. Anyway, you're unmuted now. And I don't hear the background noise now.
Is it when I talk?
No.
Okay.
Okay. Sounds fine now. Okay. I'll be quiet.
Yeah, so I think I'll just leave it at that as far as providing new information goes. So if there's anything that anybody wants to ask or discuss around it or add or critique.
You know what? I think that background noise, by the way, is from Guy when he talks. The only time I hear it. It's Lisa. I have a comment and a question.
Sure.
Okay. One, I got cut off because the power went off, the phone guy and everything, but I'm back. And so I missed a little bit of it, but I got cut off when you were talking about body work and, you know, relying on body work to do our inner work. You know, that if I release trauma in the body, I've solved all my emotional issues or whatever. One thing I can say for me, as somebody who's a pain avoider, it was very attractive to me for many years to gravitate towards exaggerated belief in modalities that didn't require any pain on my part or any looking inside. And so I know that if I'm supporting somebody else, I want to keep that in mind because I've watched family members do it too, complete avoidance. My sister must take 5,000 supplements a day. But what she believes in her mind is just killing her brain.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
So, you know, it's like sooner or later I have to turn inside and look at what I believe and or however one does that, do that inner work, that digging down deep and losing good sleep that Joni Mitchell talks about. You know, for me, that had to be done. And I wasted a lot of time looking for the easier way out.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that those aren't, you know, there aren't some value to other things. I, you know, who am I? But I do know that I use those things to avoid. And the question I have for you is, Guy, I recently, through a lot of stuff, through a lot of this through working with you guys, but anyway, I came to the conclusion that it was time to stop. I was having wild fluctuations of depression and food cravings, especially sugar. And they seem to fluctuate wildly. I was starting to think, oh, my God, maybe I'm just like a rapidly cycling bipolar.
Yeah.
What I did is I kept a log, and what I noticed is I was the days that I was fluctuating like that or going into depression, I was drinking Crystal Light, which has Splenda in it. And I was drinking 3 quarts of water with that Crystal Light liquid in it a day. And I stopped doing it. And I've always used that stuff, but I stopped that and all artificial sweeteners, including stevia right now.
Yeah.
Because I want to get normal. And I can't believe the difference. My mind is clear. I'm not tired in the afternoon. I'm sleeping well. My cluster headaches are gone. I have energy. I don't walk around going, I just can't wait till this is over so I can sit down. You know, like, I can't believe the difference. So my question is, what do you, like, you know anything about the connection between some of these artificial sweeteners? And, you know, I've heard of phenylketonurics. I don't think I'm one, but I just wonder what you thought about that or knew about that.
Well, I know as far as aspartame goes, which is in a, seems to be in a majority of the stuff. I don't know if that was one of the active ingredients in what you were drinking.
It wasn't in the specific one, but it is in the diet sodas I was drinking, and I quit those.
But I mean, you know, aspartame is one of those very toxic, like ridiculous chemicals that was pushed through via Monsanto into getting the FDA to accept it, and it's been fairly shown beyond any doubt that it's quite a powerful neurotoxin.
Wow.
So I mean, the fact that it's allowed, for anybody allowed to eat it, is criminal in itself. So I mean, there's been many cases where people get exposed to aspartame, and obviously because they're vulnerable, really start showing severe symptoms within a couple of weeks. So people that aren't that vulnerable will take a longer time, but the stuff is really going to screw up your nervous system. There's no doubt about that.
This stuff's called sucralose.
Yeah.
Splenda.
Wait, is that Splenda?
Is
okay, well, there must be something in it, too, because this isn't my imagination. It's my husband's.
No,
like, you're completely different. I don't get upset over stuff. I mean, the world blew up around here the last couple of days, and I've just been so calm, like, okay. And it's partly, you know, I'm doing a lot of work on what I believe, and, you know, I'm doing a lot of that work, but this was a pretty radical shift after I stopped that stuff, and I only stopped it because I didn't want sugar cravings, and I thought that might be contributing to it. So I wasn't preconceiving a change and then placebo affecting it, because I didn't expect this at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what a lot of people, whether it's sugar or a sugar substitute or it's honey or whatever, it still contains sugar. Otherwise, it wouldn't be sweet. You know, it's some form of glucose. It's something that that raises your sugar level of the body. You know, if you look at a lot of these alternative products, they say, you know, a quarter as sweet as sugar. Well, that really means that, you know, if you take four times the amount, it's the same as what you're taking normally. So, I mean, it just means that it's cutting down on the sugar, but it's not certainly eliminating the sugar. So if you still have a lot of that, it's still the same as having a lot of sugar, just divided by four or divided by half or whatever. So, you know, any form of sugar, whether it comes from fruit or any organic, you know, it doesn't matter. It's still a sugar, and too much sugar in the blood is a very toxic thing. You know, diabetics go blind from it and lose limbs because when sugar isn't broken down properly, it also becomes a neurotoxin. That's why you go blind, because it eats the nerve cells of your eye. So, any form of excess sugar, whether it's sweetener or natural or it's made by some Tibetan monk on a mountain, is still going to raise your blood sugar levels unnaturally. So, you know, I think you just had too much sugar, whether it was a substitute or not, and that's obviously affected you radically.
Yeah, my vision is back, my blurred vision went away, and I've had chronic diarrhea for years, and I've always used those sweeteners, and it's gone.
Yeah, I mean, blurred vision, it probably started eating away at your retina nerves.
Holy crap.
Yeah, too much sugar is really toxic. It's a really sorry.
I have a question regarding what you had. You had mentioned glutamine, and what I know of glutamine has nothing to do with what you had talked about. It's more to do with
the bodybuilder world,
right? Where it's, you know, it's, so can you go into that a little bit? How does that help brain function?
Yeah, well, glutamine is a very interesting substance. Where you obviously know it from is the bodybuilder world, because they drink a lot of glutamine for protein synthesis. Which is one of the things that it contributes towards. But in another context, what glutamine does is your stomach lining, the actual lining of your stomach is made out of a very similar substance to glutamine. So if you take fairly high doses of glutamine sort of in the morning and the evening, also glutamine has got a nice once a sedative effect, but it helps with sleep. And also the other thing that glutamine helps a great deal with is cravings. So if you have any cravings, whether it's sugar or drugs or alcohol or whatever, it actually helps reduce cravings. But its main function is to restore the actual lining of the stomach. And it does that pretty radically. So if you look at any
Hello?
You mean?
We lost you when you said you were speaking about glutamine in the stomach, but one of its main functions is to, and then we lost you.
Well, in that context, its main function is to actually help build up the stomach lining, the actual tissue of the, you know, the real interior of the tummy, because it's made out of a very similar chemical, very similar substance. So when you drink it, it pretty much goes straight to your tummy and starts working on that. So if you look at any nutritional products that are from a good brand, that normally works on helping digestion or rectifying a dysfunctional colon or whatever, you'll always see like a high dose of glutamine in it, normally about 1,000 milligram. So the cheapest way to get it is always to go to the bodybuilder section, because they sell it in huge bulk at much cheaper than the health section would. So glutamine is a pretty amazing supplement to take. And it's also one of those things, you know, it's not an artificial thing. It's a natural neurotransmitter, and a natural, natural amino acid. So, you obviously don't want to take too much of anything, but it's, you know, it's a fairly safe substance as well.
Guy, Lisa emailed a link to a Solgar product containing phosphatidylserine complex. I want to make sure that if I order that this is the right one that you're talking about, and it contains 100 milligrams of serine, of phosphatidylserine.
Yeah.
And it contains 55 milligrams of phosphatidylcholine, along with two other ingredients, phosphatidylmethanolamine and phosphatidyllinositol or something like that. But it is by Solgar. Is that the one that you read?
The choline looks a bit low to me in it. Normally you need quite a high dose of the choline. The serine looks quite high. I think most people take about 200 milligrams, but the choline looks a bit low in that particular one.
So maybe you can just supplement with additional choline?
Yeah, I would just buy separate. Just get one for serine and one for choline. If you get choline separate, it's normally quite a high dosage.
Okay.
Let me know what you find, Hamlet. I'm still researching. I'll send you anything I find, too.
I will.
A cheap way to take choline is in the granular form, which is soy lecithin, which is what a lot of people take it in. They just throw it in their cereal in the morning. And it's quite a neutral taste, I think.
Soy lecithin is choline?
Yeah. It's largely made out of phospholipids, phosphatidylcholine, yeah.
Okay.
You see it sometimes in a lot of products because it's sort of a smearing agent, but it's normally low doses.
Okay.
But I can assure you, if you take the right amount of choline and the right amount of omega-3 with a bit of serine, you'll probably feel the difference in the way you function within about 4 or 5 days.
Is the glutamine an L-glutamine?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah. The only thing to be careful for with the omega-3s and the choline is you get quite hectic headaches, or a lot of people do in the first couple of days. Which is a good sign, because what that headache is is actually your neural tissue is sort of repairing or growing quicker than it normally does, and that puts more pressure on the spinal fluid. So it's normally sort of a pressure headache that one can massage away to get your lymph glands from draining the spinal fluid to make space for your bigger brain. But after the first week, it goes away. Until your sort of cerebral fluid adjusts to that.
Guys, as far as the omega-3s, you've mentioned something regarding mercury levels. How do you know what brand? I mean, there's a well-known brand here which comes in a glass jar, and it's pretty pricey. It's about $50 for the jar. How do you know, if these things have been tested for mercury? It's such an unregulated industry.
If it has been tested, it will indicate that. There's a certain process that they put the stuff through that takes all mercury out, and all of the good ones will actually say on the bottle I think it's called pharmaceutical grade omega-3, or there's some term for it, but it will normally indicate that it's been, it's not just mercury, it's all sorts of heavy metals. So it will indicate that all the heavy metals have been taken out of it. And I mean, don't touch an omega-3 that doesn't say that. Especially if it's
what?
If it doesn't say that it's been sort of clinically or pharmaceutically purified.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Yeah. Because otherwise you take the Norwegian salmon, which is basically mercury with a bit of salmon.
Yeah.
There?
Yeah, I'm still here. Any other comments on anything?
Huh. I'm getting this strange noise.
Yeah.
It could be some interfacing between Hamlet's line and Guy's line, because I get, I show there's noise coming from Hamlet. But anyway.
It's our brainwaves. Hearing someone in the ocean. But just one thing I wanted to add, which I think you touched upon, Elisa, which is a very good point, is that if one reads a lot of stuff around the integral research, especially around the quadrants and the sort of the newest stuff around integral methodological pluralism, where it indicates that if one studies the human being, there's different lenses that will enact various aspects of human. And a lot of the people, let's say, that's into the physiological stuff, they will take that idea too far, that the body and mind is connected. So, you know, the body and mind is connected, obviously it is, but physiological therapies are more powerful on the physiological realm of the body than it would be on the mental realm. Although it will have effect on the mental as well, because all these things are interrelated. In the same way that psychological therapy will also affect the body, but it's less effective when it comes to the physiology. So what a lot of people do is they take this causal relationship too far, and say that, you know, any sort of psychological stuff will sort out bodily issues, or in the same way, any physical stuff will sort out psychological issues. So I think it's just seeing all these things in a balanced and appropriate ways that, sure, you know, dealing with psychological issues physiologically can have an effect because of cellular memory, etc. But there is a limit to that. And the same way psychology has got a limit over the body, etc. And it's got a limit over society. And so all of these realms are interconnected. You know, all four quadrants are interconnected. But specific practices in a specific quadrant is more powerful in that quadrant than it would be in the other quadrant. And if one keeps that, you know, just with a common sense and balance, then one can see the relationship without making sort of outlandish claims how these different areas relate to each other.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I love Integral, because it addresses everything and doesn't try to use one quadrant to solve all the other quadrants. It's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, so like, you know, what we spoke about now, all of these things are very useful, but, you know, most of these things aren't going to touch sides when it comes to dealing with one's anger issues that relates to, you know, dysfunctional family of origin issue. You know, you can take as much choline as you like, it's not going to really do anything about that. Might make you all think a bit clearer to deal with it, but that's about it, you know.
So, take a choline.
Yeah. Well, that's what we all did in the first place. That's why we're sitting here having this conversation. You know, let me take that. Let me take this. It will sort it out. Clearly, it didn't work for us.
Well, you know, you bring up a good point, because I've been very cautious about supplementation, because what I didn't want to get it continuing to practice is the idea that when I perceive something wrong, I take a supplement. So I'm so glad we're talking about taking supplements for the right reasons and not so that I can continue the pattern of there's something wrong with me, take a pill. So thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing about most supplements. It's not euphoric, so you don't really feel anything when you take it. So it's very difficult to get addicted to it or even cross-addict, because, you know, if you take too much calcium, it's not really going to, like, change your emotional state.
I know it's not going to get me high. I just mean there's a pattern of wanting something outside of me to solve my problem, even a supplement.
Yeah.
So I just...
Yeah.
I'm very conscious of, yes, I've got a good supplementation regimen based on good science, and now I'm going to add this to it based on good reasoning.
Yeah.
And, you know the difference, Lisa, between something that's an inner issue and something, you know, like, you can't know the exact difference, but I guess what I'm saying is I'm not worried about getting addicted to them as much as addicted to the behavior of a pill to address everything.
Yeah.
Lisa, I emailed a friend of mine here who's a gazillionaire. He owns a nutraceutical manufacturing company, and I emailed him on the supplements. So when he gets back to me, I will let you guys know.
Awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And Lisa, I would just like to say, I mean, I agree with you completely. The same can also be said for all the four other quadrants, whether it's therapy or exercise or recovery or whatever, you know, taking some things. So that's why I'm always very skeptical, always very cautious around amino acid therapy, because that's actually the few supplements that can have a very immediate effect on one's mental state. You know, if you take a lot of tyrosine or 5-HTP, you actually feel pretty euphoric quite quick. And that's a dangerous area for addicts to start experimenting, which actually a lot of people suggest. You know, take tyrosine if you're tired, and take 5-HTP if you're depressed. But they pretty I think it could be quite dangerous for addicts to get involved with that.
Right on.
But I think we ran out of time now, so.
Great call.
Yes.
Thanks, everybody.
Sure.
Yep. Great lecture, guy. Thank you.
Okay. We'll chat soon. Thanks for everyone's participation.
See you guys Friday.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye,
bye,
everyone. Bye, Victoria.
Bye.